Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we don't have a real theme for today. I think you're going to probably
They're just good books and clever people.
That's a good theme.
What do you want? They're all good. And something interesting has happened since we last spoke with you here in Pittsburgh. At last, summer has arrived.
Oh, yes.
And we're always a couple of seasons behind around here. But the tomatoes are starting to turn from green to yellow.
Really?
Unfortunately, some of the leaves are turning from green to yellow
as well.
Because it's been such a wet summer. We hope it's been not as wet where you were and that your crops are doing better than ours. But
unless you're in California, in which case we hope that you start getting
a little
bit wet.
I just said better. Better comes with a number of definitions depending where you're dry, better is wet. Where you're wet, better is dry.
Anyhow, let's get on with this because there's been an awful lot of talk
about this guy, Joe Carroll. I asked him right at the beginning. I said, why did you think the world needed yet another
grilling book?
Well, we got the story. You'll get the story, and you'll want to own it too. Okay, Joe Carroll. So somebody gave you a challenge and said, Please write another worthwhile book about barbecue. We don't have enough of them. but if Adam Perry Lang and Steve Reichlin think it's okay, I guess it must be okay.
That's right, you know.
But what makes it different is...
Well, I think, probably a lot of things, not the least of which...
Should we say, first of all, the name of it, since we're talking about it, is called Feeding the Fire?
Yes, okay. Feeding the Fire.
Go ahead.
But one of the main things is that I'm not a trained chef, and never try to pass off myself as a chef. I know a lot about food, and I know a lot about cooking, and I've been doing it since I was quite a small child. But I have never done it professionally, and I've never cooked in the kitchens of any of my places. For example, I have a strong enough knowledge and background in food that I could come up with the recipes and formulate the rub, for example, for a barbecue and put the menu together at St. Anselm. But I'm certainly not the person to be in the kitchen always executing it. I'm much more of a home cook. I love cooking. I do it all the time. So I think that obviously affects my approach to the book and is how I'm different than maybe some other people who do this. Also, I think I've been a strong believer for a long time, since I was a child, in this idea of using the best possible ingredients you could get your hands on and treating them very minimally with just a small amount of additions to help enhance the flavors.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to get a lot of argument from anybody with any amount of intelligence or savvy that would question that.
Right. But, you'd be surprised that there seems to be whether it's because people think they have to justify writing a cookbook, or they have to make it seem like there's this witchcraft cooking that only certain people can do or learn. Often you see these recipes that are just super elaborate and take hours of prep time and lots of ingredients, many of which you have to source from online. And it can get really detailed. I'm not saying that food can't be good that's prepared that way. I've enjoyed food that has been overly messed with and adjusted and manipulated by a chef, and it can come out good in the hands of a very talented chef. Just point being is most chefs aren't that talented. When you start messing with all those ingredients and doing all that stuff, you really run the risk of just muddying flavors and kind of ruining the true flavor of whatever the protein or vegetable or whatever it is you were cooking was in the first place. I call this a
Baroque culinary style. And I remember writing about one chef that did this, and I said, latch the larder is what I said.
Right.
Don't let him have one more ingredient.
Yeah, after he's got 19 ingredients, don't let him have 20. Whereas your approach was minimalist, to say the least. You have 20 chapters, and you say, I'm going to offer you 20 ideas.
Exactly.
And that's it, my friend.
And it's going to constitute a basic course, actually, in cooking with fire.
Right on. And, you know, to me, what I love so much about both barbecuing and grilling is more than most other cooking techniques, except possibly deep frying, oddly enough, that method of cooking adds a level of flavor to the food, almost like a seasoning. Uh-huh. So the wood smoke, for example, in barbecue is a seasoning, really, when you come right down to it. And the char that's created on a really hot grill from direct flame contact is also a seasoning. It creates a flavor on the meat or the vegetable, whatever it is you're putting on there, that you can really achieve no other way.
Yeah, but let me interject something here, which is where the value of this book exists. And I'm going to come to some other examples as we go along. So you talk about the different kinds of wood, and
right.
And the last thing you would do is use a Kingsford charcoal briquette, for heaven's sake.
Exactly.
But then the wood that everybody swears by, the wood that everyone says is the reason why Texas barbecue is absolutely the best in the whole universe, mesquite.
Mm-hmm.
You say the problem with mesquite is it's too strong and it's going to spoil the flavor of your food.
Well, and, you know, this goes directly to something I just said about, you know, the difference of a talented chef or somebody with skills versus, you know, somebody who's just trying learning or you know, a beginner. Mesquite can have great effect, a positive effect on barbecue, and does in many cases if you go and you barbecue throughout Texas. The problem is most people, if you didn't grow up cooking with mesquite, I mean, for example, here in the Northeast, we can't get our hands on mesquite very readily. You have to get it through specialty outlets. It's not like we grew up with, you know, mesquite everywhere. We're not in the desert. So most people don't know how to cook with mesquite. They just know it's a wood, and they treat it thusly. So they put a lot of it on there, and they let it smoke throughout the entire barbecue time, and they wind up with this really acrid, bitter, intense smoke on their barbecue, and that comes from really not knowing what to do and how to handle mesquite because it's so kind of intense and flavorful. And
no,
it's kind of, you know, it's a bit over the top as far as wood goes, as far as impact and flavor.
No, that was my point exactly. Now let's go a little further into the book, and let's talk about brisket. In some people's view, brisket is the only true barbecue. and here's what you do with true barbecue: you cook it for a very long time. And it doesn't matter if you keep it long after that. What you say, and I have no reason to doubt this, I don't think I've ever actually barbecued a brisket.
No, you haven't.
I've cooked lots of, but the secret to getting it successful to begin with is you have to brine it for a very long time. And a very long time, I think, in your case, you suggest it might even be as long as about 2 weeks.
Oh my God.
yeah, but what you're referring to specifically though is the pastrami that we do with the brisket.
Okay.
Not just our regular barbecue brisket.
Okay.
Yeah, but I wanted to go on just a little bit further because the trick is in the next part. The next part, a lot of people think, well, barbecue will then last forever. And you say, no, that's not true. When your brisket is cooked, you eat it.
Absolutely.
You don't keep
Barbecue will never taste better than the moment it comes out of the smoke or a few moments thereafter.
I agree.
You know, the cooler it gets, the collagen, the connective tissues start congealing again. And then reheating barbecue is a very tricky prospect because there's no other way of quickly warming something up and achieving that same effect that barbecuing has.
Yeah, you said 200 degrees for as long as it takes. You sprinkle with water and put some foil over it. Is that right?
You know, I'd have to see. That's not something we would normally do, so I'd have to see exactly what recipe you're referring to there. Because we never foil our barbecue, for example, at the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And we never use water in the smoker at the restaurant.
Yeah, I could have made that up.
I'm sorry. What you're talking about is not. You're talking about a reheating method, correct?
That's what I thought we were talking about.
Oh, right, yeah. Reheating. So in a reheating method, yes, that can work. Again, because the closest thing you can do, and this is what we do at the restaurant too, is steam. That's the closest thing you can do to kind of keep the moisture content there, and also not, not kind of crisp it up and not dry it out and not affect affect it in some way that all of a sudden changes what the texture of barbecue is supposed to be like. Yeah, so I'm sorry, there was a little confusion there. Yes, when it comes to reheating, that's a good way. Incorporating steam somehow into that reheating process is the best way of doing it, whether it's, you know, literally in a steamer basket or something along those lines. Steam is a gentler way. You're never gonna overheat with steam, and you will retain the moisture.
What do you think of the what's his name, the Argentinian Seven Fires guy from South America, the chef?
Are you talking about
the what?
The same publisher, Francis Melman. Is that you?
Yes, Francis Melman.
Yes.
What do you think of it? He writes with passion.
I don't know Francis. I would love to meet him. I absolutely love what he does.
I can't reach him. I've tried to interview him, and he just never. He doesn't stay in one spot long enough. He hops whole continents.
I also heard he's quite like the character too. I'd love to meet the guy. I'm fascinated by what he does.
Yeah, me too. That's why I was asking about him, because I'd like to meet him too.
So. Yeah.
Maybe you two can go off looking for him.
Yeah, we could.
But, hey.
You know, the other thing is, you have this tribute from Adam Perry Lang. I don't know where he is right now, but anyhow, we did, his approach was very interesting in charred and scruffed. I thought that was an interesting approach to barbecue. Mm-hmm. But we ate at his, when he was in partnership with Jamie Oliver, we ate at Barbara Cow in London. I didn't know exactly what Barbara Cow was, and you explain it. And never in my wildest dreams would I have, from all my exposure to the actual substance that I've served, imagine it's really a pig's head cooked in a pit.
In the most traditional sense, that's what Barbara Cow is. Yeah. Unfortunately, today, many things get passed off as Barbara Cow. Basically, any kind of, you know, Mexican barbecued like approach to cooking meat, they'll call barbacoa, which is fun enough, I guess. But traditional barbacoa was always this cow's head done in the ground.
Oh yeah, cow's head.
Pit style. Yeah, cow head. A lot of meat in the cow's head, so you know that they get a lot. You know, and cow's heads are really cheap, so it's one of those things. And really, that at the central core of what barbecue had become in this country was inexpensive cuts that you could feed a lot of people on.
I see. You know, I loved your little story about the whole hog roast, where at the end of picking the carcass clean, somebody cracked the skull.
Yes, absolutely.
We had the very first time we did a pig roast party and invited, it was in the country, and we invited all these overtly civilized beings to the farm where we did this.
Right.
And it was fascinating to watch them progress through to the point where somebody actually did crack the skull and ate the pig's brains.
Yeah.
It was something, the flame, the whole thing brings out this primitive.
They probably read they probably read the book about pigs being smart.
True. I've always been an adventurous eater. I grew up, you know, I say in the book, I grew up, my Italian grandparents living downstairs from me. So, you know, I cleaned tons of squid and ate squid with them and squinchili.
Yeah,
and my grandmother, would make, my grandfather loved a dish called, cabozzella. And cabozzella is basically a roasted lamb's head split in half.
Really?
And so I grew up seeing this and eating, like, my grandfather would love it and I'd watch him eat it and I'd want to try it and I'd see him eating the gums around the teeth and eating the eyeballs and all that stuff. So it seemed okay and normal to me. It didn't seem that weird, you know? And every now and then, you know, I'd have friends over from dinner and they'd see some stuff that we ate. Not that it was, I mean, that was like, granted, the most extreme thing. But there were lots of other smaller things that, you know, friends of mine grew up not eating that stuff.
Really
kind of weird. We freaked out by it.
Well, we know we have grandchildren who are picky eaters and not adventurous because their mother isn't. But I keep thinking of landmarks where at this age, your father had already eaten his whole own, you know, artichoke at age four.
Yeah.
And at age, you know, your age, he had his first age five whole lobster by himself, you know.
Right.
And these kids are just They're so different.
You know, my kids, I have six soon-to-be-7-year-old twins, boy-girl twins.
Oh, wow.
And my son is more adventurous than my daughter. He'll eat sushi, he'll eat a bunch of stuff that my daughter won't touch. Oddly enough, he's not into cheese, but I'm not quite sure what that's all about. Because he'll eat it on pizza, and he'll eat
it. That changes. Yeah. Anyhow, there was a funny book about a hungry monkey. Did you ever read that?
I don't think so. This guy
following his daughter, his firstborn's eating habits, and, you know, it changes by the week.
Oh, yeah. I remember my palate changing constantly as a child, constantly. Yeah. Things that I used to hate, I loved tomatoes. I remember hating tomatoes. And one day, it just clicking and realizing, I like tomatoes, you know?
Yeah, you do some really unusual things in this book. Like, it would occur to me to cook tongue on a grill, because I would think that it needs to be tenderized long and slow.
I don't remember what recipe. I know we do the...
You do tongue here somewhere.
We do the tongue pastrami, which is something we do at Fête Sal, that often we'll cook it, we'll prepare it at Fête, we'll serve it sometimes at Fête hot, but usually the majority of the tongue we do gets served cold and sliced like paper thin on a slicer at my beer bar, Spike Nugget, which is across the street.
Well, here it's pictured on a grill, on the grate, and it's charred.
Do you know what page that is? Or what?
No, I can't find it. I'm leaping madly through the book.
Yeah, as we speak, I'm going to try to look, because I'm curious to know if it is. It doesn't ring a bell on.
You know what I'd like to try in here is pulled leg of goat. We have a goat sauce.
Oh, yeah.
That would be good. You know what I think is cute about this book is how you have a picture of the animal and a little arrow, and I usually don't like those arrows pointing to where it comes from, which most people don't know anything about.
That's true. I mean, my entire wall in the dining room at Fête de Sal is butcher charts.
Yeah, I see it.
With all the breakdown, and people are just always fascinated by that, because you're right, we eat this stuff all the time. Even people who know a bit about it aren't always certain as to where this stuff comes from.
Well, you know, I'm curious, because this charring is very clearly a trend. Even beyond charring, we interviewed people from Bar Tartine and in their lab, and one of the flavorings they have is powdered burnt toast, which they use for things like flavoring ice creams.
Right.
You know, but it wasn't too long ago that somebody said that charring actually was carcinogenic.
I think that is actually true. I think you need to consume vast quantities of charred foods daily for that to really have an effect, but there is something to that, I believe. I've heard that many times from many different sources, legitimate sources.
But that's all charred. It's all charred. Okay, right. It's the beef tongue pastrami. It's page 165.
Yeah, and it's actually, that's just sitting on a hotel pan tray.
Yeah, I've read it wrong. You're right.
Yeah.
So I thought it would have a new way of, Peter loves tongue, I thought we'd have a new way of doing it.
now, I could see grilling tongue working if you were to slice it fairly thin, put it on the grill just to get some marks on it, really, and some, like, little charred flavor to it. But, yeah, you could never really cook tongue properly using a grilling technique. It would turn to rubber. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it would.
That's why I was surprised to see it.
The taste is so subtle. You wouldn't want to introduce wood to it anyway.
Tongue has a ton of fat, but it's all in these tiny, tiny little pockets throughout the tongue. It's not, not like typical muscle texture where there's striations of fat. In tongue, it's these little tiny pockets of fat. So it needs to be dealt with in a very different way. The texture, the physical makeup of the muscle is much different. But I really love tongue, and I think if tongue wasn't tongue, people would go crazy for it, because it's so tasty, and it's got a great texture, and it's just a really great cut. But I think, unfortunately, people get turned off by certain parts of
yeah, well, it's the texture that, I mean, because my grandfather used to eat tongue every day. And,
right.
You know, it was a staple in the refrigerator, and I never liked it growing up. It was only until I got grown up that I liked it.
Yeah, we have a local butcher who, not all of his meat is great, but I tell you what, he sells frozen beef tongues for $5 a piece.
Nice.
So whenever he has three, I make tongue for a week.
There you go. I really love tongue. I like it hot or cold. I really like it as like a deli meat, like sliced really thin, not sandwiches and stuff.
This book is certainly meat centric, but I want to point out you also do a section on poultry, including a whole turkey, which we've done. Peter did a goose once, which is really good. Then you also do seafood and some surprising
things
on that. And I wish I had I can't bring myself. And when I was in biology lab, I could do it, but I can't do it anymore. Is pith and slice a live lobster. I read that book, that Henry, what's the name of the Consider the Lobster, the guy who hanged himself, what's his name?
He was so impacted by the book he hanged himself. David Foster Wallace.
Yeah, David Foster Wallace. Ever since I read that article.
Let's do one more tip before we
go.
Yeah,
I am just having such a good time to you.
I understand. You can talk to him up the air for the next hour if you like.
I love seafood. I absolutely love seafood as much as I love anything else.
Our listeners are looking for some content here.
and we're socializing.
The really good advice is about scallops, and it really says don't mess with them.
Of course, yes. Scallops more than almost any other seafood.
You say they're so delicate, they're so wonderful on their own. Why would you mess with them? And the answer, of course, is your advice is you don't.
You don't. You just need, a little salt, a little bit of acid in the form of lemon or lime juice, and that's it. It's, a splash of some really nice olive oil, perhaps.
In less than 5 minutes, right?
Absolutely. I mean, scallops can go from perfect to miserable in seconds.
That's true.
More than probably any other seafood. Scallops, again, because I think the mussel texture itself, the way the mussel is formed versus fin fish, overcooked fin fish isn't great either.
No, I don't.
At least it's like you could get yourself through it. An overcooked scallop is just like right in the garbage. It's useless.
Good for repairing tires on your bicycle.
Right.
Yeah. Well, of course, you have you devote a lot of space in this book to getting the doneness right, which is probably a matter of experience as much as anything, I would think.
Absolutely, especially when it comes to barbecue. With grilling, you always have a really good thermometer to lean on. A great thermometer will do so much for you when it comes to grilling. But with barbecue, a thermometer is only a small portion of what's going to, tell you the piece of meat is done. The thermometer is just a rough guide at best when it comes to barbecue.
Well, Joe Carroll, this has been a great conversation.
Thank you.
I wish we could have dinner tonight together.
Where are you guys, in Philly?
No, we're in Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh. Yeah. It's a good 6-hour drive. It might be tough.
We live in Philly too.
I love Pittsburgh, by the way. It's a great town.
It is, actually.
I've been out there a bunch.
Great.
Mm-hmm. You get here a lot?
Well, next time you come, give us a shout.
Why do you come here a lot?
It's not like I go there a lot. I've just happened to, over the years, been there a good handful of times, and I've always had a great time. Just kind of like it. There's some cool old school little places to eat out there, and it's just a great old city I love old cities, and I love old northeastern cities, especially,
Right.
They just have such a great feel to them,
Right. Well, Peter's giving me the chop motion.
The music's playing.
Okay. Thanks, Joe Carroll, and good luck
with
your book, Feeding the Fire.
I appreciate it. Take care.
Bye.
It's time to take a break now, but after the break, we'll be back with the meat that most people think is synonymous with barbecue, which is why it takes second place to the fire on the menu. So don't go away, and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We always love talking to Chef Kevin Gillespie. He's always has something new on the drawing board. And in fact, he just started a group for, as an umbrella for his restaurants. It's called Red Beard Restaurants. And anybody who's ever met him or seen a photograph of him understands why it's called Red Beard.
I think we can figure that one out. Yeah. If it was German, it would be, Latin would be Barbarossa, right? Like in the famous Frederick Barbarossa we all learned about in the history of the Middle Ages. But anyway.
His book is called Pure Pork Awesomeness. And you'll find in this book everything you ever need to know about pork. Chef Kevin Gillespie, your book, Pure Pork Awesomeness, is a rather awesome book, but tell me, I mean, you open it up with an introduction about kissing a pig. You're fond of them, but not that fond, are you?
No, I don't think I would actually kiss a pig. I just, you know, it's the name of a Ray Stevens song that I used to love when I was a child that my father, I remember he had a cassette of that song in his truck, and I would hear it, and it just, I don't know, I've always had an affinity for them. I always have liked pigs my whole life.
So for you, lipstick on a pig is not a joke.
Right, exactly.
Now, what color do they prefer, Kevin?
You know what? I think anything pink, right? Isn't that what pigs prefer? So.
I don't know. I figured you were closer than me, so you'd be the right person to ask.
Well, you know, you're known for your love of pigs. You're also known for your Southern food ways of affinity, but this book, it's all about pig, but it's global, isn't it?
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, I think most people, when they heard that I was going to write a book about pork, they assumed it would all be Southern recipes, and right. It certainly could have been. We could have written a whole book that way. But honestly, when I started to put the book down on paper, what I realized was that such a large portion of the world reveres that animal, and they use it tremendously in so many different cuisines, it seemed crazy not to include them. And so the book quickly took a turn and became really an expression of the whole world's love of pork and all you could do with it.
Well, you don't take anything for granted. And you explain your fondness for this little piggy in your introduction. And then you also, I love that. Why couldn't you not catch that little piglet?
They're really fast. I think people take for granted, like, a very small pig is incredibly fast, and children are not very coordinated. So you mix those two things together and it makes it pretty difficult.
Oh, this is a childhood story because
yes.
I'm reminded of the time we were at that place in West Devon with the couple that had the restaurant.
Yeah.
And they also had a small group of pigs, and the pigs got away.
Yeah, just yeah, as exactly. We were arriving.
There was some kind of big brown heirloom pig variety.
No, I thought it was little black pigs.
They were brown.
Huh. And they were quick.
You what? I'm sorry, what?
I said it's all about strategy when you're trying to catch pigs. It's not, you won't catch them. They're much faster than we are, but you can strategize a little bit.
Well, they all came out of the woods at once. You know, and they didn't. Nobody expected that. In fact, they never expected to have this many pigs. Why? I don't know that they couldn't figure out. You buy a male and a female pig as a present, and then pretty soon you have a whole herd of them.
that's because these people were in the bedding shop business before they were farmers. They didn't know a lot about pigs.
Well, you have this section on pig farming, which I think most people who know anything about that agree with you that pigs, as intelligent as they are, or any animal like that, deserves consideration. They don't need to suffer. They should be allowed to be natural in their actions. And I told you, I don't know if you've read that, I read that Barry Esterbrook's book, Pigtails, and I said I'd never eat another pork chop again.
but his book was inspired by The Perfect Pork Chop.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You take on a really strong admiration for the animals that you're raising once you get into doing that. You can very easily, as a cook, I think, take for granted the sacrifice that's being made, especially nowadays when you can go to the grocery store and you can buy a pork chop, like you said, and that's just something that's wrapped up in a package, and you don't really have to connect where that came from. And I think that moment of actually learning all that went into getting that animal into a position where it makes its way onto the plate and hopefully people love it and you treat it with courtesy is something that most cooks could benefit from, because it's a very sobering experience, and I think that it helps people not neglect technique, and it helps people really appreciate how to make something great. It just, I don't know, it transforms you as a cook, in my opinion.
Well, you say the same as Tony from Percy's in West Devon, who used to take his pigs off to be slaughtered at a butcher shop in the nearby village, and he for all the world pretended it was like they were going on a vacation.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, what's interesting is that they are very perceptive, and so there's certainly a school of thought that says that you want to make sure that the least amount of tension can be placed on them as possible. And when we raise our animals, we make sure that they have plenty of love and attention and TLC, and that they get a chance to, you know, roam around and live their life. And I feel very good about the efforts that we and a lot of other people in the business are putting forth now. And I think you're starting to see the market change. And people say, you know what, I'll spend a little bit more money because I want something that's better.
Now, when you say we, so you're not only a restaurateur with a restaurant called Gun Show in Atlanta, which we must mention, and an emerging group of other restaurants, but you also are also a pig farmer.
Yes, exactly. My brother-in-law and I own a farm in Missouri together where we raise cattle and pigs. I shouldn't take too much credit for it. My major role in it is more selecting, going, okay, those are the ones we want. This is the better bloodline. He does all the hard work, but it's a very time consuming experience.
Yeah, well, now you also give a lot of information. This is a cookbook, but you really give a lot of information about pigs. I mean, you break down the different breeds, for example.
Right.
I want to know where you get all these adorable photographs of pigs.
Those are actually all shot on our farm, and my wife shot pretty much all of them herself. So we were just out in Missouri on the farm one day, and she had her camera with her, and she just started snapping photos, and that's where all of those pictures came from.
Really? Well, I mean, we interviewed someone who has an animal sanctuary, or several of them, and he's vegan and holistic and whatever, but anyhow, he had all these adorable photographs of pigs kissing each other, you know. I wondered if there was some sort of underground promotion thing for pigs.
No, they're just very photogenic animals, so it makes it easy on you.
Uh-huh. Now let's go back to the book, because I'm a little confused, because you have various different colored pages that include what you call worth knowing, and then you've got other little paragraphs that are slightly different name.
Well, you have the paper clips information.
So what's the difference between worth knowing and the other things?
Well, you know, what we do is anytime we write a recipe, I try to throw in some sort of extra tip, whether it's a piece of information that I think is going to make the recipe more successful to you, maybe a cooking tip or a good to know, or here's the secret aha moment, as my one of my recipe testers likes to call it, and something that we go, you know, we can't really articulate it in the actual description of the recipe, but adding that other little piece of information could make you go, oh, okay, that's how it works. You know, the good to know section is one of those where you don't need to know this in order to make the dish, but I always like to put context to things. I think that I remember how to do things better, not just cooking, but just in life in general, if I understand all the little pieces that sort of surround it. Why? How? What was the driving factor? And so I like to include those in the book because I feel like it gives the reader a more well-rounded experience regarding the food.
Now, you and your primer for pig parts. It's pretty self-explanatory. But, you know, I was thinking to myself, you know, I don't know if I've ever had pork shoulder.
Oh, you definitely have had pork shoulder before. You know, that's the funny thing. A lot of people take for granted what pieces are what. You know, you go to the grocery store, and it's largely the confusing piece of the store that can throw people off, because the same thing can have many, many different names. But pork shoulder is an incredible cut that has shown up in the cooking all across the world. Basically, every sort of braised pork that you can imagine, whether it be carnitas in a Mexican restaurant or traditional American barbecue here in the South, that's using pork shoulder. It's so unbelievably juicy because it has a nice amount of intramuscular fat, and it's a nice cut to use as an alternative to the more expensive pork chops and pork loins, because despite what people believe, they think that it's tough and it has to be cooked a long time. The truth is you can actually cut it into steaks and it grills up very nicely, and it costs a fraction of the price.
Really? Well, yep. I mean, I know what a picnic ham is.
Right, so a picnic ham, exactly, another part of the shoulder closer down to sort of the leg joint area. But you know, there's a few little sort of secret cuts of the pork shoulder that people are always surprised by. Going to your butcher and asking them for pork steak is one of the best, because most people don't know what it is, but it's just a bisected pork shoulder. It looks like a T-bone steak, and you cook it the exact same way you would. You put it on your grill, get some nice color on it, season it with salt and pepper, and you get to eat a 22-ounce steak that costs about $3. So it works out pretty good.
Now, not surprisingly, you have a section where you pay great tribute to bacon.
And yes,
of course,
bacon.
We've had people like Jim Vilas, who wrote an entire book about bacon because he felt it. But you give up your little secret and say, my favorite pork isn't bacon, it's sausage.
Yes.
Why is that?
I've always had a love affair with sausages. I think they're so fantastic. I love the variation that you see. I mean, that's the issue, is that I love bacon. But bacon, even in its subtleties, even with everybody having their own different, slightly different recipe, bacon is a flavor that you recognize instantaneously, and it has a certain emotion to it. And although it's delicious, I love the variants that show up in sausage, from dry sausages in China to the beautiful various and assorted types that are grilled in Germany and Austria, all the way down to the spicy sausages that, like andouille or boudin, that you see here in the United States that people don't even realize are sausages. And so I just think that there's so much more that you can do with them, so many more flavors you can experiment with, and that's what makes them fun.
Now, we have a local butcher just about a mile and a half from here who I buy sausage from every once in a while, and he makes a sausage called mutt.
I don't know what that is. I've never heard of that before.
Mutt sausage is all the leftover sausage fillings.
Together.
From all the brands they're making. Everything from chorizo to
goat.
Yeah, to English bangers. Every kind of sausage he makes, he mixes it all up. And
that sounds pretty good.
He makes a sausage out of that. And the wonderful part about it is it's only $4 a pound.
Right, perfect.
And
makes you wonder how many cats are in there.
No, our grandchildren came once, and I bought like four or five different varieties, but I bought 3 pounds of mutt, and that was the one everybody liked the best.
Right. That sounds good to me. I think that would be the one I would enjoy as well.
Now, you have here a really good Cuban sandwich, but it doesn't sound to me like the husband of my cousin who was Cuban made.
Well, you know what? There's a couple different variations on the Cuban sandwich, and I found this out doing the research for it, that the first, quote, Cuban sandwich that kind of was popularized in the United States was actually around the area of Tampa and Sarasota in Florida, not in Miami. And it's a slightly different way of making a Cuban sandwich. And I had a chance to go down to Florida and try out all the different sort of spins, and I fell in love with that, I guess you'd say, Western North Florida style of the Cuban sandwich, and that's what I modeled that one after.
I see. So that's why it's different.
Now, which one is which one is the medianoche?
The medianoche is more similar to what I have in my book, but it's on a bread that's made with pineapple juice, so it makes the bread really sweet.
Ew. Well, not my thing.
Yeah, you wouldn't like that.
No, I wouldn't like that.
You don't like bread anyway. You're a fascist or a communist. Or
no,
something.
I like good bread. I don't like crummy bread.
She doesn't like toast. So her personal trainer thinks she's a communist. Because who else would not like bread made into toast?
You have family, some of your mother's recipes in here, too. I'm looking at the pan-fried pork chops with sauce.
Oh, that's one of my favorites. Yes.
Is that because of nostalgia, or is that because of flavor?
It's both. It really is. It is absolutely delicious. A fried pork chop with a cream gravy is a home run, in my opinion. But simultaneous to that, my mom is not a great cook, and she didn't do the majority of the cooking in my family. We actually ate at my grandmother's house almost every single day. And so there were only a few things that my mom cooked and cooked well, and that's one of them. So I think that it's a mix of those together. It's that not only is it delicious, but it's also one of the things that my mom would make for me that I remember going, oh, wow, this is really great. And so it was a favorite that I requested quite frequently.
Right. Now, you have a whole section here on hams, and I think that hams are always something that's up for debate. Now, you said you didn't like ham for a large part of your life, and then you had
right.
this life-changing experience where you encountered prosciutto. Well,
yes.
That to me is, I mean, I know it's ham, but that to me is not like what you get as ham in this country.
Well, that's what's interesting is that that's the kind of, and that's the idea behind that chapter, is that the word ham is incredibly vague. You know, in truth, the word ham is actually just the descriptor for that rear leg, not the way that it's prepared. And
right.
so when you think about it like that, I think it opens up a freedom to kind of take it in a lot of different directions, whether they be the dry-cured hams like prosciutto or serrano or even country ham like we have here in the U.S., or the old-fashioned baked ham, which actually can be great if it's done well.
Yeah, I mean, I use Madeira and apple juice and something else in mine. And mustard, Dijon, and
right.
cloves. I mean, I make it do, but I still don't like it very much.
Well, you know what? That's the thing, is that we've actually done a lot of experimentation here at one of my newest restaurants, Revival, which is all very traditional Southern and American cookery. And we found a technique for producing ham that made something that was absolutely amazing. And that's the thing, is that unfortunately when you're dealing with a cut of meat like the ham, which is actually really lean by nature, you have to bring a lot of flavor to the table, and you have to keep it really moist. And those are the two most challenging parts.
But I think it's slimy. I don't like the texture of ham, roast ham like they do here. But boy, I'll tell you, I like Parma, I love the Spanish hams, the
right.
jamons, and we went in Tuscany to the King of Culatello's place, and he had a B&B, and also we got to tour the...
He had a mansion, it wasn't
he had a
B&B.
Mansion.
but
it was a mansion, and the smell was so spectacular. We had how many? 6,000
Yeah, he was kind of
hanging.
He was kind of low on stocks. So he only had 6,000 Culatellos in his,
yeah,
in his
wow,
touring
yeah,
room.
Just a couple left. You know, one of my favorite ways actually to prepare ham, to prepare the ham, I guess you should say, is actually to have it deboned while it's still raw in an uncured state,
yeah.
and then fillet them out and marinate them and grill them. It actually cooks up with a very similar texture to hanger steak,
really?
And I think it's absolutely wonderful. It's a very lean, naturally quite healthful cut of pork, and so it's a great alternative for someone who wants lean meat that they can use on the grill. It cooks very quickly. And like I said, it has a hanger steak or a flank steak almost texture to it.
It sounds like the gammon that my mother used to like, which is sort of like bacon, except it's from a part where it's a lot leaner. So
right, exactly.
So there's a chunk of fat on one edge of it, but then the rest of it is very, very pure pink and fat-free sort of meat.
Right. I actually wanted to put a recipe for that in here as well, but it ended up getting cut. So unfortunately, that was one that got chopped on the chopping block. They said it was too obscure, so that one might show up in the outtake. So.
Well, it's not at all obscure in England. I can assure you of that.
What's obscure?
A gammon rasher. I mean,
not the least
bit obscure.
Huh. Yeah, exactly. And I just when we were writing that chapter that was talking about bacon, you know, I included a recipe for jowl bacon and for shoulder bacon and for belly bacon, but I really wanted to include, you know, more of a traditional rashers style where you have a very lean bacon with only a spot of fat on the end of it. So if you're missing that flavor, I would highly suggest that you try the recipe for shoulder bacon. That's the closest I can get
in this
country. Yeah.
Well, he even includes pork and apple pasties.
Okay.
Oh, yes. So one side of my family is from, my grandparents are from Scotland. And so we ate a lot of, I guess, British fare, as you would say. And we didn't call them pasties, but that was the word that everyone agreed most people knew better. But just the idea of hand pies, like savory meat pies. And so I wanted to include one in here. I never had a pork one as a child. We didn't make them that way. But I've experimented as an adult. And for me, anything that I can put HP sauce in, I'm pretty much on board with. That's okay.
Oh, no. Pork pies are big. It's all over England. I mean, they have national contests. for who makes the best pork pie, and it's the pork is cold, and all the jelly, all the gravy solidifies
right.
into jelly, and then if you're really sophisticated, you can warm it up so that moistens, and then you serve it with mushy peas.
And
that shall be the end of today's program.
Well, I want to ask one more thing: is what about pig's ears? Do you have anything in here about pig's ears?
No, that was another one that got cut out. We tried to, you know what, for a little while we did have a chapter in the book that used a lot more of the obscure cuts. And what I decided when we were looking at the book in its totality was that my goal was to get people excited and to give them more opportunity to use something that they could find in their day-to-day life. And so I eliminated the whole chunk of the book that was trying to tell people how to cook pig tails and pig ears and said, let me focus on getting people to know how to cook a pork chop the right way, and then we'll go from there with the next books that come out. So
you're going to have another book that says this is the obscure parts.
Right. Well, we actually did make an outtake chapter that you can get it if you order the book directly from me. You get a lost chapter that includes a lot of really obscure recipes, like how to including how to do a Roman porchetta, like out of an entire hog. So it's ones that got cut that were either considered too difficult or too obscure.
Now,
sounds like worth having.
Yeah. Now, what's the website they used to do that?
You go to redbeardmerch.com.
MERCH?
Yep, exactly. Redbeardmerch.com. And that's where you can find this book. You can find my first book, Fire in My Belly, along with a number of other things. We do T-shirts and coffee and everything else that you could imagine putting your name or face on. So they can find a lot of Chef Kevin Gillespie articles there.
Kevin, you're so busy all the time and in so many different directions.
I know. It's some days there's not a lot of time for sleep. We'll just say that. So.
Yeah. Anyhow, well, we enjoyed this, and I'm glad to see you moving ahead with more restaurants and more activities, and keep us posted.
Thank you guys very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yes, you're very welcome. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you. And, I hope to see you. Are you going to be in Nashville, perchance?
Not until sometime in the fall.
The Music City. Are you going to be at Music City?
Yeah, it's fun. I'm hoping to get up there. It's just right now we got a lot on the plate, so we haven't started nailing down too much of the fall schedule as far as setting dates for sure at the moment, but we will soon.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Finishing up today's program, one of the most talented writers and illustrators we have ever come across, sweetheart, right? Mi Comida Latina.
It's a delightful book.
Absolutely delightful book.
Yeah, and it's, as Peter said, it's Marcella, I guess it really is, Kriebel's original book was published as a Kickstarter project. A hand-lettered and printed and hand-illustrated with charming, charming watercolors. And this current published edition reproduces that effort. It's a total delight from all points of view.
And the book, of course, is called Mi Comida Latina.
Right. Marcella Kriebel, this is such a gorgeous book, Mi Comida Latina. And it's also, it's so intimate and personal that I feel like you and I have been friends for a long time.
Thank you so much. That was definitely intentional. The book is actually really a refined version of my sketchbook journal that I kept during times of travel. I traveled throughout Central and South America, and as well as Puerto Rico. kind of on again, off again over the last 10 years or so, starting with study abroad in Quito, Ecuador, where I was there for a semester and then returned for another 6 months. But from there, I kind of worked my way north and intentionally stayed with people in their homes and cooked with people.
Well, now you... I noticed that you come by this artistic talent pretty naturally, because I think it's genetic. Both your grandfathers were artists.
That's correct, yeah. both my parents are artists. My mom is a fiber artist, and my dad is a woodworker. Growing up, I had all kinds of art materials and different things kind of at my fingertips to experiment with. And then I ended up majoring in arts and as well as cultural anthropology. And it was the anthropology focus that led me to traveling throughout Latin America. So keeping a sketchbook journal, again, was just a very natural thing as an artist. So I do consider the book kind of equal parts art portfolio and art project as well as a functional cookbook.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's filled with illustrations. Charming illustrations, hand lettering, sometimes even handwriting, but it's also each page is laid out as a separate art.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, and that was all very much fun. I mean, each and every page has its own composition, and every single page is hand lettered. There are no computer fonts in the book, and often people are surprised to think of that, because in this day and age, you can actually create a font. Your handwriting by essentially scanning the entire alphabet and then digitizing each letter.
Really? That's interesting.
You know. But I didn't do it that way. I actually did, each page is its own image. So it was quite a tedious task, I will admit, to edit.
Now, how many years did it take you?
You know, it took me only 1 year to actually intentionally put the book together. However, the recipes, like I said, are from travels past, and what I did was I went through all these sketchbook journals that I had and refined these thumbnail sketches and directions that I had kept, just kind of taking notes with people. So I cooked with my host parents. I cooked with some of the maids that stayed in these middle-class homes and cooked for the families that I stayed with. And again, I found it just so much fun to get to know people through cooking with them. It was very easy to get into talking about family rituals and why prepare the fish just that way or cut the onion this way and who taught them how to do that. I found that all very fascinating. So I took notes during that. And so during this year of producing the book, it was more like going through all of these journals that I had from the past years and taking out bits and pieces of knowledge that I found really fascinating and fun, and I wanted to share all of this information and these dishes, moreover, with my family and friends here in the U.S. So that was the goal behind producing the book.
Now, you started it, you were self-publishing, and you had a Kickstarter campaign?
Correct, yes. So towards the end of the year of production, I had all of the book finished, but I needed to find a way to garner funds to produce an edition of this book. So I found about 5 different printers and got estimates for 150 copies. And I knew that I really wanted to create an art piece. So I was very sure I wanted a hardback book with coated 100-pound paper.
Oh, the paper's
so that it would
great.
Be a cherished item, you know,
yeah,
for my family and
terrific.
Friends.
Yeah, I mean.
Thank you. Yeah. So I produced a video with a friend of mine who is a wonderful video maker. I mean, she's an editor and videographer. Anyway, she made a video for me that was just stunning, and that's what we used for the Kickstarter campaign. And in 1 month, I raised almost 6 times my monetary goal, which meant that I got to produce 1,000 copies and share it with many more people than it originally anticipated.
Why do you think that was?
I think that my story is compelling. I think that when you, just as you admitted just now, when you look through these pages, you can see that there is this narrative, and the images are captivating, but there's an attachment immediately when you look at these illustrations. And I think that the video really demonstrated that well. So, and you can still look up the video on Kickstarter if you look up my name or the title of the book, Comida Latina, and you can watch the video, and it really is captivating.
And, you know, it's also informative. I mean, I honed in on this mango, how to eat a mango without peeling or anything, because I keep coming across this at my farmer's market, boxes of mangoes. There are about a dozen for $5.
And
I keep thinking, well, there are only two of us, so we really can't eat that many.
Right. Yeah, so I believe it's the ones that are sort of kidney-shaped are fun to eat just by essentially massaging that mango.
Yeah.
And then you pick out the top of the stem, and you kind of suck out the flesh, leaving that seed sort of suspended in the peel. And that is a technique that you'll see a lot of people do. Well, I saw it in Colombia and in Ecuador as well. I'm sure people do it in other places where that same variety is available on the street.
Yeah,
you buy one.
But I like also how to cut up a mango, because when I get my big box of mangoes, and I want to figure out how to cut them up so I can freeze them. They freeze okay, but you have to give them a shape.
They're great for smoothies too. Yeah, the fun thing that I also love to incorporate were those infographics, and that page in particular is real fun because I've sort of illuminated how you do it, kind of a crosshatch cut, and then cutting it ultimately into three pieces. So the middle is the seed, and then the left and the right are the majority of the flesh, and you do this cross cut, and then you flip it over so it kind of looks like a turtle back or something, and remove those cubes. So it's a lot of fun.
So, and the recipes themselves are wonderful. If you can get past looking at the gorgeous illustrations, and you cover a lot of ground in these.
Yeah, I try to, and honestly, the recipes reflect an array of different countries, and for the most part, they're very simple. These are home-style recipes, so there's a lot of stews, very simple salads, things that are pretty relatively quick to prepare.
Causa, the Peruvian.
The causa, yes.
Yeah.
That's a good example of how I offer alternative ingredients. In certain recipes, there are things that are perhaps a little challenging to find here in the U.S. Ají amarillo is one of the peppers that is ubiquitous in Peruvian cooking. Yeah. And it's challenging to find here. You can find it in a paste, in a jar, but even that sometimes is tough to find. So I do offer an alternative that you can use a roasted red pepper, which doesn't produce the exact same taste, but that's so just to point out, all of these recipes can be made here in the U.S., and I do describe those original ingredients, but offer alternatives. So,
well, I'll tell you, it's a great accomplishment, I think. And
thanks.
I feel like trying out your pisco sour recipe.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a good
one?
That's
a classic.
So you do have drinks in here as well.
I do have drinks. I've got desserts. I've split it up by category. So it is kind of main dishes, salsas and sides, and then again, desserts and drinks. There's a full index in the back. There's a glossary in addition to that, which describes all of the Spanish words that I've used.
Yeah, that's the other thing. You can, when you have a picture of something that's recognizable, and then you give the Spanish word for it, so it's also a language study program.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you've done all of this, so what's next?
Well, as a full-time artist, I'm always making stuff. I've got a series of illustrations that are all food-related that I offer as art prints. I also have a paper goods line, so note cards and greeting cards, that kind of thing. But I am so excited about doing another book, indeed, and I want it to be just as illustration-focused I'd like to do a book surrounding farmers markets.
Farmers markets?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. I love farmers markets because they are community hubs, but they offer sustenance. And there's, again, with food, food is about storytelling, and there's a narrative there with the origin of all the prepared food that one has to offer at a farmer's market, in addition to where all of these different fruits and vegetables came from. And so I'd love to do a comprehensive kind of overview, but very illustrative.
I mean, farmer's markets around the world, or just in the United States, or what?
Probably just domestic.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that there's enough there. Yeah. I currently live in Washington, D.C., but I identify a lot with the Pacific Northwest, which is where
you
grew up.
You went to school, yeah.
And, I went to school there, too. But there's some real contrast to be had, too, with differences in farmers markets.
Oh, that's true, indeed.
You know, East Coast, West Coast stuff. So.
Two things I wanted to ask you. One, let's not forget to list your site.
Oh, sure. My website is my name, so it's marcellacreble.com, and my name is spelled MarcellaCreible, B as in boy, EL.
Okay, and the other thing is, I was very curious. The person who, or the house that published Burgess
Ray
Press, how can they afford to donate 100% of after-tax profits on the sale of each book to culinary education, hunger relief, farmland preservation, and other food-related causes?
Isn't that wonderful?
How can they do that?
So the best way to kind of compare them to something that we're all familiar with is by thinking about how Newman's Own does it. So they take care of everyone that does the work, and then that money that's left over, they donate to worthy causes. So each one of their authors, or each book project for that matter, has its own nonprofit. So my book, all of the profits go to a nonprofit called Adelante Mujeres, and that means Onward Women, and it's a nonprofit that supports Latin American women in Washington County, which is where I'm from, in Oregon, with a variety of social programs, business planning, after-school programs, workshops, and teaching sessions on organic gardening and how to grow a business sustainably. So I was able to select that nonprofit, and I'm very excited that they will get some proceeds from this book. So.
This is a good story and a worthwhile story all the way around. So I commend
you
on this, Marcella, and it's good to meet you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate it, Anne.
I can't wait to see the second book.
Yes.
Oh, thank you so much, Marcella.
Thank you.
Such a charming young lady and such a charming piece of work, sweetheart, right?
Yes, indeed.
We can hardly wait for her to come up with the next beautiful illustrated book about a fascinating subject we're sure she's going to. And we'll be back much sooner than that, because we'll be back with you next week, same time, same place. We hope you'll join us then. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.